Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we're going to hear from Dan Albrecht of the Black Keys on his new solo album, Waiting on a Song, and the future of his band. And then we're going to dig into the life and legend of the great Greg Allman. Dan's new album is a real departure made with some great Nashville session guys. It has a bright, open feel that's really like nothing else in his whole catalog. It's almost his Nashville skyline. And I think we'll start by hearing the title track, which he actually co-wrote with John Prine, and then we'll get right into my conversation with Dan Albrecht. So obviously you co-wrote the title track with Prine. What was that process like? Who brought what? How did it come together?
Well, that particular, we've written a few songs together now, but that was the one that made the record. And that one in particular, he came with the first couplet and just started strumming the guitar. And we worked away at it. And, you know, that one happened pretty quickly. And it was sort of like an instant sing-along for all of us. And and that's sort of part of that magic that you're trying to capture. And, you know, you don't know if you're going to get it that day, but sometimes it happens, you know. And that was definitely a good moment.
He came in with a couple lines and you chime in with the next one. It just kind of popped in.
Yeah. He came in with, I've been thinking, I've been humming, I've been picking, I've been strumming, waiting on a song. And then he said, I've been hitching, I've been thumbing. And then I just finished it. I said, I can almost hear one coming. And yeah, like 20 minutes later, we had the song finished and we were just kind of singing it over and over again.
Yeah, it sort of feels like it's always been there, which is always a pretty good sign.
I know, yeah. I know, I'm telling you. It was, that was the feeling. Like, we just were all singing it. We knew it already. Like, by the time the first chorus came around, you knew the song already.
Dan, you're pretty new to co-writing, right? I mean, that's a very, it's almost, it must be in the water in Nashville. Like, it's a co-writing town.
The thing is, I grew up playing all these songs that were all co-written. Like, with my family, all of those songs that I sang were, like, co-writes. And then I started a rock and roll band. And never co-wrote ever. Just it was like we wrote, Bat and I wrote in the studio together, and it you know, we kind of used the studio as a tool to write with. And
I guess Pat was your co-writer sort of.
Yeah, but it wasn't like we just it was nothing like just sitting down with an acoustic guitar or sitting down with a piano and writing chords and melodies. It was not like that at all. So this is more the sort of classic traditional. The thing that Nashville is so known for, you know, the songwriting tradition. And I'd never tried it before. I'd never gotten to a room with someone and put just a couple acoustic guitars and tried to write songs. So it was new for me, but I loved it right away and started doing it all the time.
What does it bring that your other process didn't bring?
Well, I mean, I think it's really nice every day, you know, you're writing with a different person. And all of these people, they have their own thing, you know, their own magic thing that they do, that they're great at. So, I mean, I think what you're trying to do is, trying to bring the best out of each other, you know. And if you get lucky, that's what happens.
We talked about John Prine, obviously. It was, you know, pretty much, unless you have like Dylan as your co-writer, that's about as good as you're going to do. But tell me about some of the other people you wrote with on this record.
I wrote a bunch of the songs with Pat McLaughlin and David Ferguson. And those two guys, you know, we spent all summer together writing. Fergie hooked me up with a bunch of these writers. But we would write almost every day. And the last song on the record called Show Me, I wrote that with Bobby Wood, and he writes on the piano. He writes on the Wurlitzer, which is nice. It's the first time I've ever written on with a Wurlitzer. And there's a line in there that says, the character's 20 miles out of Tupelo, and that's where Bobby grew up. It was 20 miles outside of Tupelo.
Let's hear Show Me for a minute. There's nothing you can say. Do you pump these guys for like Elvis stories? Did you ever tempted?
Bobby always said that Elvis told him never be a name dropper. I mean, yeah, that's a faucet that never gets turned off. I mean, they just always tell stories. I mean, that's what it is, you know. And yeah, they've got amazing stories. I mean, Dwayne told me this crazy story about Elvis. He was hanging out with Elvis just in the hotel room, just the two of them, in Vegas, and Elvis asked him if he knew of any way that he could get away from his manager. He asked Dwayne that.
Wow.
It was heavy, yeah.
This is Dwayne Eddy, by the way.
Yeah, Dwayne Eddy, yeah.
Who is a monster, badass, legendary guitar player who plays on, I think, two tracks on your album.
Maybe even more. I mean, he was just there all summer. He was just another one of the crew.
How did you get to know him?
I met him 5 years ago with Fergie. We went out to lunch, and we hit it off, but we really hit it off when he came to the studio, because he's a freak for the studio, just like me. I mean, you know, the more you think about it, I mean, that's how he created his guitar sound, was being in the studio with Lee Hazlewood, experimenting, you know, with these giant water tanks, you know.
What does he show up with? Does he have a guitar and amp that he
always
to, yeah, what's,
always.
So what does he have? Like,
he's got his own signature Gretsch.
Yeah.
And his own signature baritone.
Wow.
And he brings his Music Man Fender amp with the big 15-inch JBL. That's the secret. And a tremolo pedal. And it just sounds like Dwayne. He starts playing and it's just him. Mm. It couldn't be anybody but him, you know, which is wild. Because Mark Knopfler also plays on the record. And he starts playing and it could only be him.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's so interesting to, when you get somebody on an instrument that so many millions of people play, that, you know, you can make it sound so much your own. That's just so wild.
One of the tracks Dwayne plays on, I believe, is Living in Sin, right? So let's hear a little bit of that, yeah.
Last night, you seem to deal with it all right. Girl, you know that I meant well. I promise you that.
Definitely
I
one of my favorite songs on the record. Tell me about just like writing and recording that one.
That was just awesome. It sounded just like that in the headphones when we got it, really. I mean, it did. It felt like that. You know, we're just so locked in. There's no edits on that or anything. It just, even the harmonies were live with Pat. So Pat and I wrote that together at my house. Dwayne played the solo, just this righteous, ripping, simple solo, you know, because he plays another solo on another song. And it's this beautiful, flowing, like West Coast melody, you know, but on that song, that's what, you know, all these guys are so great at. They know what to, you know, they listen to the song and the song tells them what to play. Do you know what I mean?
When you have Dwayne Eddy about to record a solo for one of your songs on your solo album, do you tell him what to do? Do you give him any?
No, I don't tell Dwayne. He's really good at coming up with parts.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to tell people if I have an idea, but you know, the great thing about most all these guys is that I don't have to say anything because their ideas are better than mine.
Do you get gun-shy at all playing guitar in front of like a Dwayne Eddy?
No. Because we do our own thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't get insecure about it. But I mean, I just do whatever the song needs. You know, I played mostly acoustic rhythm guitar, you know, got really big into playing rhythm guitar, locking in with the drums. You know, just being a little bit more concerned with the fabric of the song, less about any one particular strand, you know?
So you wake up in the morning like a regular person and you're in the studio at 9 a.m. So is it like a 9-to-5 thing? How does it work for you?
Well, yeah, I get to the studio like 9 and work all day long. Go home for dinner, cook dinner. And then maybe if I need to do some overdubs, I'll go back till a little bit later. Or I can be done. But yeah, I like to work all day long. I like to start early.
Was that always the case, like the early Black Keys days, or were you ever like a late night recording?
No, man. No. I'm always been a morning person, but I always waited till noon because Pat likes to sleep in. So, but I'd always have to wake him up.
Do you still have trouble sleeping? I remember that was a big thing for you.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I'll sleep 6 hours, then I'm done. I don't sleep any more than that. You know? So, if I go to bed at 9 p.m., yeah, I'm up in the middle of the night after 6 hours.
So how would you sum up this time of your career? Because it seems like a real time of sort of freedom and exploration and evolution that's really different from maybe any other time. I'm curious how you see it.
I feel, yeah, it's all of that. But it also is me sort of, I feel like it's the most me that I've ever been, really. You know, I mean, when I did my first solo record, it was similar. I just didn't have these guys. You know, I mean, I was doing a very similar thing. Like, if I'd have had all these guys, I could have played those songs, you know, songs like Trouble Weighs a Ton. And
yeah.
You know what I mean? Those are country songs, sort of, you know?
Well, it's funny. I went back and listened again to the first solo record. Let's hear Trouble Weighs a Ton.
What's wrong, dear brother? Have you lost your faith?
The thing is, mood-wise, it's very different.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's kind of what, one of the main things that made me think, like, wow, is Dan feels like he's in a different place emotionally, especially at that point.
You know, I told you I recorded like 200 songs. They're not like all up-tempo and happy. You know, these are the 10 that worked best together as a record, I thought. You know, I had to like strip myself away and I just didn't want to be that cliche dude who like puts a double album out. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Just because I have all the songs.
Were you tempted? Were you tempted a little
no.
bit?
No.
No. Okay.
Not at all. I didn't want to do that because I wanted the songs to like speak the best that they could. You know, there are a couple songs I knew I wanted to release, like Waiting on a Song, because I liked how it felt, and a song like Living in Sin, because I liked that. So then when I start to add to those two songs, I want them to all kind of feel similar. So that just, you know, by picking those as the starting point, it kind of like shaped the rest of the record, how it ended up feeling. But I've got a bunch of songs that are like dark and moody and stormy with Dwayne playing big, low guitar on, you know?
Wow. Then I would be asking you like, Dan, what's wrong? Is what
exactly,
you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I do love that people get this feeling from the whole record as a whole, because I think that's people telling me that I did it right. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
The record has a feeling to it, a spirit.
One of the reactions I had to the record, which is that there's some George Harrison occasionally in some moments, but I don't think that was something you were thinking at all.
No, I love George Harrison, but I've never really listened to any of his solo records, you know, other than hearing some of the singles on radio. But I don't know. I honestly didn't listen to anything. I didn't read anything. I didn't listen to anything. I didn't go see any movies. All I did was work on music.
Mm.
And I wasn't really thinking about anything other than just trying to make new stuff. I didn't want to do any covers. We didn't cover any old songs. You know, we just were working on new songs every day. And I completely shut off. I wasn't on the internet at all. It was really freeing, just the whole experience.
So you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. We're here with the great Dan Auerbach, and we'll be right back with a whole lot more.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in.
I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
How conscious were you of avoiding sort of your old
not at
approaches?
All.
Yeah.
I didn't think about anything. I just went in and did it. That's it. And it was day to day, and we were writing and recording and having picking parties, and, you know, I'm like singing bluegrass songs with Del McCurry, and, you know, it was the feeling of all that music and all the community. Do you know what I mean? I think that that's sort of what I wanted to get across on the record. The thing that I was starting to feel was, it was the studio just kind of like came to life, and it just became a place where everyone was hanging out, and the music got stronger, I think, because of it.
yeah, you're sort of having these picking parties like at home, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which are very much, as we said, kind of like the ones at like family reunions as a kid.
Exactly, so, like it, with my uncles there. I'll bring my uncles come in and they sing and, you know, the McCurials will be there. So it'll be like two generations of my family, three generations of the McCurries, you know, singing all these songs. You know, bluegrass, mostly bluegrass songs, but...
What kind of songs? But, like, tell me which, like...
You know, well, because Del is, he's in the, I grew up in the Stanley Brothers, you know, but I didn't know that there was, like, a line drawn in the sand, like, between, there's Stanley Brothers people, and there's Bill Monroe people.
Interesting.
Yeah, like, so when I first got together with Dwayne, I was like, let's, you know any Stanley Brothers songs? And he's like, no, I don't know, you know? But he knows every single Bill Monroe song ever written, even B-sides, you know? But...
And how much of that, how well do you know all that stuff? Like...
I know some of them.
Yeah.
You know? But I was more into, I know more of the Stanley Brothers stuff.
Hmm.
Yeah. But we'll sing like, Can't You Hear Me Calling? Del and I sing that one together all the time. And Columbus Stockade Blues. And,
Let's hear an old version of Columbus Stockade Blues just to get a feel for it.
Way down in Columbus, Georgia,
so I'd imagine that stuff, playing that stuff for fun and then going in the morning and recording new music, it must kind of get in your headspace.
Well, the thing is, we started at the picking parties, we just started playing like Waiting on a Song.
Wow.
You know? And with all the McCurries playing along and singing, it's like just sort of becoming another song that we sing in the round, sort of, you know? So it really was all part of the same thing.
How important is it to you to be able to evolve? Because already 5 years ago, you'd already gone through more evolution than most artists get a chance to nowadays. When you listen to the big come up... And go to 2010, 2011, 2000, it was a huge evolution, and now it feels like another leap. So how important is it to you to be able to kind of just keep moving forward and not be stuck in one thing?
I think it's really important. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to do because, you know, you make money touring. That's how you make a living in the music business, unless you're writing top 40 hits, which I don't do that, you know? So it's a hard way to live. You know, being on the road all the time, and it's not a creative way to live for me. You know what I mean? It's hard for me to make music when I'm on the road. But I think the thing that I've found now is that I don't want to be thinking about any of that. I just don't. I don't want to intellectualize this thing that I do. You know, because that's not what it's for. You know, I was really fortunate. I was raised with music, and it's a part of my life. And man, there's a picture on the back of the record of all the guys who play on it, and it's got like Prine, and it's got, you know, Kenny Malone and Bobby Wood and Gene Chrisman and Dwayne and Kenny Vaughn and all these incredible musicians. And, you know, pretty much every single one of them, they all grew up on playing music with their family, you know? So it's just, I don't know. I don't know. It's almost like I feel like I'm really just making music and not even thinking about the music business at all, you know?
What do you like about, there's a bunch of like older guys, not exclusively, but a lot of older dudes that you've been hanging around with and playing with. You obviously get something out of that. What is it?
They're incredible musicians. That's it. I wouldn't hang out with them if they weren't great at what they did. You know, I mean, I love that they tell great stories and stuff, but that's not why I hang out with them. You know, I hang out with them because they're the best, like the best drummers, the best keyboard players. And you know, you listen to a song like Shine On Me, which is on the radio now, that's doing really well, and like the drummer's 80 years old.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with their age. There's a fire, there's a spirit that these guys have, and it's special. And I'm just trying to be around it as much as I can.
Do you want to be doing this in, you know, 20 years, 30 years? Do you think about that? But do you want to be like the old dude?
I mean, that's the thing, is that it's who I am.
Yeah.
I mean, it is me. Yeah. I will be doing it. I mean, that's because that's what I do. You know, it's what I've always done.
It's easier to imagine doing this current thing that you do, hanging in the studio, cranking out songs, than like touring and playing Black Keys songs necessarily in 30 years. But who knows?
I mean, you know, Pat and I have always sort of been like reluctant rock stars. You know what I mean? We don't like the idea of rock. We just, just that word makes me want to cringe. You know what I mean? I hate, you know, I mean, it's just, doesn't usually turn out good for rock guys. Do you know what I mean? And I don't know, man, I've never really felt like one to begin with. So I don't know. I like what Pat and I do. I wouldn't be worried about doing what we do, 'cause it's always been pretty natural too. You know, I love a little theater, but like, that's not Pat and I, you know what I mean?
Mm.
We're not going to be swinging samurai swords on stage, you know, with like beams of light shooting everywhere and fireworks, you know.
I'd like to see one tour like that, though.
I don't even know everyone. If I could do it.
Platform boots. Just
with
go.
A straight face. Yeah, platform boots.
What's the kind of current state of your relationship? Are you guys in regular contact? Do you take breaks from each other when you're on a break like this? How does that kind of work?
I mean, yeah, we text and stuff, you know, but we don't really hang out that much. But, you know, we've seen enough of each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he anxious to get back to the keys, or is it kind of a mutual?
He wants to, but he's, you know, he just says whenever you're ready. He's enjoying his time off too.
Do you have any sense of when you'll be ready, or is that just like not in your head right now?
Yeah, it's not really in my head at the moment, but yeah, I mean, I just haven't really even had time to think about it, to be honest.
It's going to be really interesting, honestly, to have you come back to that stricture and that band after you've gone so, like, impressively wild in your directions of music. I'm kind of excited and interested to see how that all kind of fits back in, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the last time I did a solo record, we came back and we did Brothers together. So, right? I think, yeah.
That's correct, yeah.
I like that record.
So you're putting a lot of pressure for when, if and when this happens, that but it will happen, right? This is,
yeah,
no,
I'm sure.
No,
I know it's going to happen, but I just don't know when. Couldn't tell you. I love making music with Pat. Yeah, I'm not worried about it. It's its own thing. And that's what's so cool about it. It gets to be its own thing.
You have your own thing now. You have your own studio. You have your own label. It feels like you want to step aside and make your own little base. Do you feel alienated from the state of the pop industry?
I don't really know. I don't think about it too much. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about it, to be honest.
Yeah.
Well, I know.
Come on, you produced a Lana Del Rey record, man. That was a
I know, but not because I had pop hits, man.
Yeah, no, I know.
You know, yeah. And you know, her label was definitely would have been way stoked if she'd have just gone over made a record with Dr. Luke. I'm sure. Do you know what I mean? She had to really fight to be able to record that stuff with me.
Yeah, we talked about that. Yeah,
yeah. So, you know, I've always just made music that I like, just because I like it and just because it interests me. I mean, that's what I'm going to do, I think. It's served me up until this point, you know?
There really aren't a lot of people who have that freedom, especially in the
music
business. I
know it. I don't take it for granted, man. I understand it, but I don't know. I definitely feel blessed. Really, honestly, man. And what, you know, just being able to like make music with all these guys has just been such a crazy year for me. It's been so eye-opening.
So what happens to the other like 90 songs or whatever from that you made?
I'm going to just continue to like try to better them. Like try to like see if I can beat them.
Did you write them or actually record them? They're like, you could play them for me now, and they're like arranged and like...
They have like strings on them and girl and background vocals.
Really?
And,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, they're done. Yeah, the studio is just going so strong at the moment. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, they talk about Stax or Motown. They had their stable of musicians. That's exactly what's going on at my place. And, you know, they never move their drums or anything at Motown. I haven't moved the drums for like 2 years, you know. Everything's sort of set up. It's a ton of instruments, but they're just kind of in their place now. And we go pretty quickly. I mean, we move really fast when we're in the studio.
So are you like hemorrhaging money paying all these guys?
Yeah, I'm definitely spending a lot of money. I'm not cutting any corners, but like I said, we work efficiently. You know what I mean? Like in a normal day, we can cut 4 or 5 songs, you know?
So basically what you did with your rock star money was funnel it back into this like amazing creative freedom and project that you're doing.
And I turn down lots of money for touring to like stay at home and spend my money.
Dan, you're crazy, Dan.
I know. I definitely, part of me feels crazy for doing it because you know my mentality about, you know, I came from the Midwest and, you know, nothing was ever handed to us. So it's always been hard for Pat and I to like turn down a tour because we're like, they want to offer us how much money? Yeah, we got to go do it, you know? So it's always been hard for us. So it was hard up until even last year to like clear my calendar. But I'm so glad that I did it, you know? And I don't know if it'll ever pay for itself, but I feel fulfilled in a way that I don't know that I've felt before.
The big come up, I think, has its like 15th anniversary. When you listen to the earliest Black Keys stuff, what does it sound like to you now?
I mean, it's fun. I love listening to it. I love to hear it. You know, it just sounds like enthusiasm and I can hear all the stuff that I was listening to. I can, you know, I'm so connected to all that stuff because I remember what mics we used and the little amps that we used and the guitars. And I remember like, you know, seeing T-Model Ford and then cutting certain songs and, you know, I'm reminded of all that kind of stuff.
And what would the you who made those early records, what would they think of this, like your new solo record?
Oh, I have no idea.
Would you have sort of believed that you could have made something like that back? You know what I mean? Because it's such, so
not
many
then.
Steps. Yeah.
No, not then. I wouldn't have known even where to begin. We were so clueless. That's that's kind of why we did everything ourselves, because we were way too scared to ask anybody for help. And we were in Akron, so it wasn't like there was a huge scene. There were only a couple people with, like, you know, for real legit studios, and they wouldn't let us touch anything, you know. So it's taken a long time. It's really hard to navigate the waters, especially recording, man. It's really hard to be a band and know what to do, where to spend your money, that kind of thing. It took years to figure that stuff out.
And that was me talking with Dan Auerbach about his new solo album and about the future of the Black Keys. And we're going to take a break and be right back with Mark Bonelli to talk about the late Greg Allman. I have with me today in the studio Mark Bonelli. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Brian.
So Mark is a longtime Rolling Stone writer, and he wrote the final Rolling Stone profile of Greg Allman back in 2009. And I wanted to have Mark in and talk a little bit about Greg and your experiences with him. I mean, we were talking about where he lived. It was like a gated community. He was in kind of a lonely place. What was your experience of kind of first going in and meeting with him?
Yeah, I think it got him at a weird time. He'd just broken up with his sixth wife. So one of the very first things he said to me when I walked into his house was, yeah, it's been lonely times up here lately. So he lived just outside of Savannah in a gated community, as you said. Sort of, you know, not a real MTV Cribs style crib. It was like a sort of standard, you know, rich guy's suburban house in a lot of ways. I guess the two cribsier touches were there was a framed photograph of him feeding ice cream to a tiger.
Yeah, I read that in your story and it did raise some questions. Do you know what were the circumstances of this,
you know,
this ice cream tiger?
A lot
encounter?
Of other stuff was going on, so I didn't get to ask. It feels very Walk Hard, doesn't it? Yeah. Doesn't he have a tiger in Walk Hard?
And what else was cool there?
The other very strange, just funny little detail was a buddy of his came over, just a regular, not a musician, like a fishing buddy, I think, and he brought us some lunch from this like southern right. place, including Brunswick stew, which is their local specialty. The guy, you know, his marriage had just broken up, so the guy was asking how he's doing, you know, things like that, and then he suddenly said, so did she take the barber chairs? And Greg was like, no, I got the barber chairs. And I didn't know what they were talking about. And then later he took me on a tour of the house, and in his bedroom, sure enough, there were these two vintage, like perfectly restored barber chairs. Again, I'll always regret this. I did not ask him what the barber chairs were for.
The significance of the barber chair.
In your bedroom. But
maybe that's what he sat in when they shot his foot to get out of the draft.
Yes, could be.
So that is one of the most intense getting out of the draft for Vietnam stories I've ever heard in my entire life. What were the circumstances? What did he do?
He was drafted, and they had a foot shooting party. So apparently, as the legend goes, Dwayne, his brother, painted a target on his left foot on the moccasin he was wearing, and Greg drank a lot of whiskey and I think took a bunch of speed and then shot himself in the foot.
And it worked.
Did work, yeah.
So one of the things you get out in your story is how haunted he was by the loss of Dwayne and also his father. They had lost their father in this really Southern Gothic kind of murder, right? And he was already mentally ill. He picked up a hitchhiker and the guy just flat out murdered him, and then they were left with a single mom, right?
Yeah, when Greg was like 2 years old, so he really didn't know his father at all. I guess the father had been in the Korean War, came back with pretty bad PTSD, was murdered by a hitchhiker, as you said. And when I spoke to Butch Trux for my story, he said that Dwayne had been sort of like a father figure to him in many ways. Although Greg also spoke a lot about how Dwayne would, you know, the crazy fights they would get into. I mean, he told one story about how he was like, yeah, my brother hung me once. And I was like, what? Yeah. And they were like playing some sort of cowboy game. And then like Dwayne taught him how to make a noose and convinced him to tied around his neck and tied the other end to a tree, and then somehow like got him to forget about the noose and told him there were cookies in the house or something. So he ran and choked himself, and he told me he was blue as a goose. But yeah, anyway, Dwayne died, you know, it's crazy to think. I mean, the band formed in 69. He was dead in 71 in a motorcycle accident in Macon. And then a year later, almost to the date, something like three blocks away from where Dwayne had died, the bass player also died in a motorcycle accident. So there was lots of tragedy in this band from a very early date.
What sense did you get of Greg's kind of relationship to the blues? He felt pretty comfortable with it. He didn't feel like any appropriation, clearly. He felt like this was a music he could not only sing, but write songs in that form and just kind of embrace the blues. What was your sense about that relationship?
Yeah, he was definitely a blues fanatic. I mean, in fact, while I don't know if this even made it into the story, but while we were talking, he had on, and this is going to sound like a plug, but he had on a satellite radio one of the blues stations in the background, just sort of playing on his television the whole time we were talking. And he would periodically like kind of stop the story and like either to sort of tell me to listen to a song or like to kind of critique a song as not being bluesy enough and they shouldn't be playing it. Or so, you know, he had a real sort of deep, passionate love and jazz as well. He and his brother both. I mean, Greg is a keyboardist, really loved Jimmy Smith, the jazz organist. So
it's interesting. He also seemed so lonely that he was actually looking on like something like classmates.com to find partners for like a trip. Is that?
Yeah. Well, he told me two separate stories. The classmates.com story was, that was startling to hear, you know, Greg Allman saying that he'd just found this website and was looking up old friends. And he also had a trip planned to go to Jamaica, and he ended up canceling it because he couldn't find anybody to go with him, which was it was sad. I mean, his marriage had just broken up.
And what he came to a realization right about all his marriages finally?
Yeah, he started to say something about his most recent ex-wife, and then kind of stopped himself and said, you know, only a fool tells half a story, you know, and just basically said it was not right for him to be talking about her when she wasn't there to defend herself. And then he paused for a second and he said, to tell you the truth, I've had six wives. I'm starting to think it was me.
He had kind of like a real ability to, like, only a fool tells a half a tale. He had like a ton of these kind of like old Southernisms in him, right?
He was very Southern, yeah. And to your question about the blues, I mean, I think he sort of, you know, he was a deeply Southern guy. And so I think some of what maybe sounds to our ears now like a sort of appropriation, it's coming out of a genuine place. You know, he was like, Jacksonville is, it's Florida, but it's like the part of Florida that's still very like Georgia-ish, I think.
Right. What was your sense of his feelings about the band's accomplishments? Like, how much pride did he have in kind of the Allman Brothers and their place in the world?
I think he recognized it. I mean, when I talked to him, I think they were right about, I don't think they'd played those shows yet. They were coming up on their 40th anniversary, so they did like something like 15 shows at the Beacon Theater that year. And so, yeah, he was very much aware of his place in rock history. And I think, you know, you look back at, I, you know, I personally going to the story, it was fun. It was a funny one for me to do because I wasn't a super fan in any way. Right. I don't know if you grew up listening to them at all, but I think some of it maybe is like a regional classic rock radio differences. Yeah. I've talked to people like Rob Sheffield about this, like what he would hear in Boston versus what I would hear in Detroit. For some reason in Detroit, when I was growing up, they just did not play the Allman Brothers.
They did in New York. So on that level, anyone who is like sort of a classic rock person, definitely. But did you become a fan to a certain extent?
Yeah. So I mostly agreed to do the story when they came to me because he just seemed like such a great character and I didn't really know the music. And you've probably made the same calculations. We write profiles for different reasons. Sometimes you're a huge fan, sometimes it's just like this person is probably going to be interesting in some way. So I went back and I really got into the early records. I mean, oddly, my favorite of their records, I think, which is something that real Allman fans would probably hate me for, is Brothers and Sisters, the one
interesting,
the non-Dwayne one of the early run of records. And I think I'm not a big jam band sort of fan, so I think I like that they're short, concise songs.
Tell me about his relationship to substances. By the time you got with him, he was sober, though smoking weed, and that's a kind of a typical rock star way of being sober, which is they're sober, but of course they're still smoking weed. Yeah. Like, what are we, animal theory? You know,
George Clinton, I did a profile of him a few years ago, and it was the same thing. And he was never not smoking weed the whole time.
I'm sober, he said, smoking a joint. Yeah, it's very typical.
He'd said I think he'd been sober since 95 or so, he told me. When I got him, he had just been diagnosed with Hep C, so he was not super well. But in the early days, the stories were crazy. When they would tour really early on, they would have like big jugs of Robitussin. they had the syrup way before. He told stories about how they got this pure form of psilocybin from some guy they knew in a lab, and they would have it for breakfast every morning for like 8 weeks straight just to see what would happen. And then he personally, really struggled with a heroin addiction. He apparently started using heroin a lot after Dwayne died. And, pretty famously, like when he was married to Cher later in the 70s, he passed out in a restaurant and face first into a plate of spaghetti. And there were lots of stories like that.
Alcohol-wise, he at one point had a booze schedule to try to keep him in check, right?
Yes, I found that interesting. It was specifically for when they were on tour. So I think his schedule was he would do a shot every 2 hours, because if he let it go for longer than that, he would start to get the shakes and that would affect his playing. But if he overdid it, then he would be sort of too drunk and slurry. But although he did admit to me that sometimes he did shots between the shots and cheated. it's not a perfect science.
The other thing that you really get across is something that people who haven't maybe followed the rock press over the years and just know the music might not understand, is the fact that he was seen as something of a rock and roll villain for many years. As you say, not quite Ike Turner, but was seen as, kind of a bad guy. Why was that?
Yeah, he was, he had a very prickly reputation. I have to say, I had a very pleasant time with him. He was much older, of course, and just kind of mellow and, just seemed like a very sweet guy to me. But if you go back, as I did before the piece, and read, all of the major Rolling Stone stories about him, starting with the famous Cameron Crowe story that partly inspired Almost Famous, he's a very prickly character. Later on in the 70s, as I said, married to Cher, he apparently pulled a knife on her during their honeymoon. Their marriage only lasted 9 days, I think. There was a big coke bust of the band that he got wrapped up in, and he apparently flipped on one of this roadie and basically testified against him, and the other band members just didn't talk to him for years after that.
I was just reading his defense on that, which is, the other band members were in court. They didn't see how they were, how the prosecutors were holding my deposition against me and threatening me with perjury and just like, what would you do, man? And it's like, so I guess there's a defense. But yes, I mean, to fans and to the band, like he was the dude who like narked on someone, and that was not cool in the 70s.
One thing I didn't ask him about, I think they were like pretty tight with Carter, weren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, I know he was definitely in with the Capricorn Records people.
We have a story by Michael Gilmore in the next issue of Rolling Stone. It's a great kind of life-spanning piece, as Michael tends to do. And one of the things that comes up is, you know, they were tight with Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was a big fan. There's an anecdote where Carter was alone with Greg Allman, and I think they're drinking whiskey. So Carter says, Greg, I'm going to be the next president of the United States. And Greg just couldn't believe it. And then the next thing he says, and I need some money. So then the Allman Brothers did a bunch of fundraisers. And that's a weird sort of footnote, is the tightness with Jimmy Carter. So what else sort of happened in your time with Greg that stands out in your mind?
I actually saw him twice. I met up with him again in New York. I mean, a funny sort of thing about that was he was like not doing as well that second time. He thought I was from Motocross magazine. He was just, I really had a great time with him. I mean, he was a hard person to interview. I'm sure you've had this experience yourself, Brian, profiling people. He didn't tell a super linear story, so it was hard to convey in print.
Right. There's a fun part of your piece where I think he's trying to tell you something like maybe the first time he smoked pot.
First time he smoked pot in New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it just veers off in like possibly 7 to 8 directions.
Yeah.
And I think what's cool about what you did is rather than just like ignore that and try to like make it make sense, you actually kind of let it play out. Like, here's what it's like inside of the brand of Greg Allman. And it seemed like it was kind of a twisty place, let's face it.
Yeah, I felt like I had to do it at least once in the piece just to sort of show the readers what it was like. But I mean, the rest of the quotes were heavily, you know, extracted from stories like that. That was really what it was like being with him, at least at that time.
So did he seem sad?
It's hard. I hesitate to just sort of psychoanalyze the guy based on, you know, spending an afternoon with him. But yeah, based on...
Of course, that was your job with this piece, but yes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the fact that he said told me he was lonely, me, a reporter, that like one of the first things he said to me, the detail about classmates.com. Yeah, I think he was kind of rattling around in this big house by himself and was probably feeling a little bit wistful.
What was your sense about the long break they took and then his resumption of the Allman Brothers band? I mean, what did it mean to him that they had kind of had this whole second act?
I think, you know, that was an interesting time. I mean, when I talked to Butch Trucks about that, he said basically, yeah, we took the 80s off.
Because of disco, he said.
Because he blamed it on disco, yeah. As those guys of a certain age tend to do. But then they, you know, they kind of perfectly slid right into the jam band thing. Those Beacon shows were every year. I mean, even after I saw him, I mean, we were talking before we went on the air. I think he pretty much toured up until the end.
Pretty much until the end, yeah.
So he, you know, he sort of lived for it. And when he wasn't touring with the Allman Brothers, he did solo shows. It was his life, I think.
So I've been talking with Mark Benelli about his great 2009 profile of Greg Allman, who passed away recently. And early in the show, we heard from Dan Auerbach about his new solo album. And this has been our episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. We'll be back next week at 1 p.m. on Volume. And in the meantime, check us out as a podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to subscribe. And we will see you next week.